Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. And I'm together with Jack Hutchins again. Jack, welcome back. How are you doing?
Hey, Michael. Thanks a lot for having me. I'm good. Thank you. I've been out on the bike today. Lovely day for it. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you. I've been in the pool, not swimming though. It was a baby swim, so that was a lot of fun. But like I told you before, the logistics of that, at least for the first time, was probably as hard as doing a triathlon. So that's my experience of it. But it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. Today's topic that we have in store is around athlete profiling and specifically physiological profiling. So maybe a nice appetizer to get into that topic is I want to ask you, what is your physiological profile? How do you see yourself and how does that influence the way you train or other aspects of your performance?
Yeah, good question. I just wanted to touch on, you didn't have the baby doing 10 400s in the pool. Yeah, hopefully not too long for him. But yeah, so myself as a profile, I come from a track running background where I was not really suited to it at the time, but I did a lot of lactate work and I became very glycolytic. So therefore, I came to triathlon with a very fast twitch profile and I responded very well to a lot of tempo work, which I guess had been missing from my training, from kind of the 800 specific training that I was doing. But since then, I've found my more, I guess, natural profile, genetic profile is more of a kind of slow twitch, flatter power duration curve, which works well for 70.3 racing. But I now have to make sure that I'm introducing enough glycolytic or top end work ahead of the sprint distance tries that I'm doing so I can also cope with the repeated surges of those technical bike courses on the tandem. Yeah. What about yourself? How do you profile yourself?
Yeah. Just one follow up there for listeners that are not aware that we're talking about guiding in paratriathlon. Mm-hmm. And those are sprint distance races that you also do. And yeah, myself, I've always felt from a pretty young age that even back in when I was playing football or soccer, that I was very much an endurance profile. I could go for a long time, not necessarily fast, and definitely not feeling like I was an explosive athlete by any means. So I think that, yeah, that's influenced my training in a few ways. I feel like I've tended to respond well to high volume when I've had the chance to do that, and also responded quite well to a lot of or decent amount of threshold work or heavy domain work, like slightly lower than threshold. And sometimes if I struggled in training, it's often been with the higher intensities, the glycolytic work, the VO2 max work, but that's, and I'm sure we'll get into that as well. That's something that I've also found over the years, ways of getting around that, like how to adapt that sort of training to my profile, to a more flat power curve. And that I think has been key as well, because to not train that just kind of makes it more of a weakness, more of a limiter. So I have to train that, but I have to train it in the right way. And I think that this is the types of questions that we'll get into with today's episode. And maybe before we get into implications and so on, we should define more specifically what physiological profiling is. So if I give it a go first, and in this context, at least that we're talking about, we're really talking about functionally, your power duration curve, your speed duration curve is a big part of it, maybe not the whole part of it, but how explosive are you? How much power can you produce at short durations versus how much power can you produce at very long durations? Is it very flat that you don't have a big punch, but you can hold a pretty high percentage of FTP or even VO2 max for a long time? Or is it and speed wise same thing for running and swimming, and it physiologically that would tend to correlate, at least from a genetic perspective, with your muscle fiber type composition, so how much fast twitch versus slow twitch fibers do you have, and I tend to also use that as a shorthand description of someone being fast twitch dominant versus slow twitch dominant. Basically what I mean by that is not that I've done a muscle biopsy of the athlete, but that somebody's quite explosive, of maybe not naturally having a lot of endurance versus the other thing, somebody not lacking explosivity, but having better natural endurance, I guess. So that's very simplistically how I would describe or define physiological profiling. What do you have something to add to that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely agree. And I think just maybe to further add to the power duration curve, we're talking about different all-out efforts, right? Your kind of best effort at different durations, whether that be power or speed on the run and in the pool, and how that kind of drop-off happens as the distance extends, basically, and how steep or flat that curve obviously depends on how much we can sustain that power or pace as we extend. I mean, yeah, agree with your terminology there, the fast twitch versus slow twitch, the speed versus diesel engine. And I guess just to expand a little bit as well, is we're looking to maybe define the zones a little bit as well, right? Rather than just it being the one end to the other of a spectrum, we're trying to figure out where is potentially LT1, LT2, VO2 max, how high is your VLA max, where maybe your fat max is, or your fractional utilization, which is a percentage of your threshold that you can, percentage of your VO2 max that you can hold as at threshold. And yeah, I mean, a more advanced athlete can have a high VO2 max, but they can still be a slow twitch athlete based on their profile as well, right? So there's definitely some nuance there.
Yeah. And I think those physiological markers, those anchor points or reference points, if you will, I think they also become very important when it comes to the implications. So to give you one example, in my, like, a heuristic that I would use is that somebody who has more of a slow twitch dominant profile, it's kind of okay for them often to do more of their endurance training a bit closer to LT1. It's not necessarily something that I prescribe directly, but if it happens naturally and the athlete doesn't show any issues with that, I would be quite okay with that. But if I have an athlete that is much more of a fast twitch dominant profile and I see that they're constantly going out and riding close to LT1 or running close to LT1, I would definitely try to pull them back, because I think that's a bit of a risky proposition. I think you can have, or yeah, there are different training heuristics that I use similar to that around the other points or the other more intensity domains, probably, rather than the reference points, the physiological markers. So I think that's absolutely right, that you need to figure out the zones as a whole and those markers as well. And like you said as well, it's not just about putting an athlete in one of two boxes. It's a lot of athletes are going to fall somewhere in the middle, and then you can fall a bit more towards one or a bit more towards the other, but it's probably like a bell curve. So the vast majority of athletes are not going to be on any one of the extremes. And so maybe when we talk about examples today where they might fall more into the extremes, because that makes it a bit more easy to illustrate. But it's important to remember, I think, for athletes, that most athletes won't fall towards any of the extremes, and a lot of athletes will fall somewhere in the middle, where maybe a little bit of those things like training implications are relevant, but perhaps not to a very large extent as they might be for somebody on more of a far end of the spectrum. Let's maybe then discuss why it matters. I mentioned the heuristics of, for example, how you do your endurance training. And I think that, to me, one of the main things with physiological profiling is fatigability. And so somebody who has more of a fast twitch dominant profile, I would see them as more likely to, or they would fatigue more easily, both within sessions, between sessions, and recover more slowly, because fast twitch fibers, they have that characteristic compared to slow twitch fibers. They can produce much more force, but it also takes them longer to recover from that effort compared to slow twitch fibers. So that's one of the main implications, that we care about this because it has an impact on how quickly you recover and how much fatigue you accumulate. And yeah, that's probably the biggest one for me. I will say, though, that although that's a big factor the profile, physiological profiling is a big factor with fatigability. I think it pales in comparison to life stress and just normal life recovery. So it's not everything. That's another important thing to point out as well, that you could be very fast twitch dominant profile that physiologically you might be kind of set up to recover quite well. But if you have a very stressful life, very busy job, you don't get enough sleep, then that's not going to help you from just not recovering properly, right? So it's only one of many different things that we need to account for. But yeah, that's, I guess, in terms of why we care about it, for me, that's the big one. There are definitely a lot of smaller ones, but I'm curious to hear what you have to say about why physiological profiling is important.
Yeah, no, 100% agree that the life stress and how we, what we're doing around the training is probably going to influence things a little bit more on a day-to-day basis, but we're going to get into a few more of the implications, right? The differences we're going to be making from a training prescription point. But I guess for me, a nice way of thinking about it is if you're someone who's just doing the classic FTP test, maybe a 20-minute test or a different duration, you could have two athletes that have the same 20-minute power, and based off that, the same FTP estimation, right? But one athlete might have very similar or can only push a little bit more for, say, a 5-minute power, and another athlete might be able to push a lot higher. So obviously, those are two completely different profiles, and that's why it's really important to do this profiling versus just sticking to, you know, a flat out critical power, FTP 20-minute one-off test, because we can assume that the guy with the higher 5-minute power is going to have a higher VO2 max. And then obviously training prescription and everything around that is going to be different and they're going to have different needs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have much to add there. I just want to add one point to what I said before about fatigability, which is that there's some great research on that, which I put in the show notes by Phil Bellinger, and I've also had interviewed him on the show. So one paper that I looked up now that we talked about in that interview is a muscle fiber typology is associated with the incident of overreaching in response to overload training. So just for listeners that are really interested in the research and science side of things, that's a good paper to look at for understanding a bit more about the different fatigue profiles of muscle fiber, different muscle fiber typologies. But I think that's probably enough of a background. So let's discuss how we actually do the profiling. Why don't you start, Jack? How do you go about this?
Yeah, sure. So the first thing I'm looking at is the training history of the athlete. So as I said, for myself, I came from a middle distance running background. That's quite telling with the type of training that I've done and the type of profile that I probably developed in that time. We can also look at other explosive sports and not just the training that they've done for those sports, but how they feel like they may have performed, like you said yourself, right? That you weren't able to maybe have such a good performance level at those more explosive sports. And I think that's a quite crude and basic place to start. But from there, I like to look at the racing and training data. So this is basically trying to build that power duration curve or speed duration curve from performances in races, events, and even in training as well. So we can start to see, without having to do any new testing, what kind of that curve is looking like, how that curve's looking. And, you know, if the 5-minute power is high, then we know that the VO2 max is probably going to be good. But if there's a big drop off to the 20-minute, then maybe the threshold and the fractional utilization is going to be limited there. So in terms of me starting with an athlete, or if I have an athlete in front of me and I want to make sure and we want to do some profiling there and then I like to use some critical power testing. I like to do the testing all in one session just to limit the interruption to training. It doesn't work with everyone, but doing a 5-minute and a 20-minute in the same day with a decent recovery between. And then obviously I need to take into account that maybe the performance in that 20-minute is going to be slightly reduced to what it would be if we did it on another day. But from there, we can get the critical power and a W prime, which is the capacity above critical power, which again is something that we can manipulate and make sure that we're, and basically from there we can kind of get an idea of how fast switch versus slow switch an athlete is based on how high that number is. Same in the pool with critical speed testing. I like to use a 200 and an 800, and we're looking at the drop off there and the D prime, which is the capacity above that critical speed. If the athlete has a lactate meter, I like to use a step test as well, looking to seeing what's the difference between the LT1, LT2, how close is that? And even sometimes a VLA max test where we're doing an all-out effort and then looking at how high the lactate goes following that test. What's your typical protocols and do they differ much from what I've used there?
A lot of it is the same. Like using the training history, racing history is probably the first one. If an athlete overperforms over 5K compared to the marathon, for example, then that's already very telling. Well, it could of course be training related rather than profile related, but it's a good starting point. And then you look at training data, like you said, and you can form a good initial speed duration or power duration curve just based on the training data that already exists without formal testing. So I guess the only differences there would be that, I also use critical power testing, but I do tend to do it over several days. So typically three different tests over 3 different days. And I don't do this for running necessarily because I just think that it's just a bit more demanding. The mechanical load of that is just on a different level compared to swimming or cycling. But swimming in the pool and on the bike, I like to use 3 different tests on 3 days. It does depend though. Some athletes I don't do that with. It would be more with intermediate to advanced athletes perhaps, because otherwise it might be a little bit overkill with a beginner to do that, I think. Although in some cases it can still be useful. But that's the main difference, I guess. And then there are maybe some other things as well. I think the athlete's enjoyment of different types of training is a big one as well. If an athlete tells me that they really like to do a certain type of session, let's say if they love to do threshold sessions with lots of intervals at threshold and not just short ones, but 8-minute threshold intervals, 10-minute threshold intervals, then that already tells me that I'm likely dealing with a more of a slow twitch dominant profile in many cases. And same thing if an athlete is telling me that they don't like to do a half marathon because it's too fast, it's too intense, then that's also probably a slow twitch profile. They want to do marathons and maybe even longer. So those are a couple of other things more on the psychological side. Then, I think peak lactate from wherever you get it, really. So you mentioned the VLA max test, and I think that's a great way of getting at it. But you can also, if an athlete has a lactate meter, when you do a critical power test that you might do anyway, then just keep sampling lactate after the test for every 2 minutes until you reach the maximum. And this might take 5, even up to 10 minutes in some cases until the lactate keeps going up, up, up. It's not at its maximum right at the end of a 3-minute max test. And this is true, the shorter the test is, the more true that is. So for a true VLA max test, like a 20-second test, then that's where you definitely need to keep sampling for a long time. But anyway, my point there was that if the athlete has a lactate meter and we're going to do a critical power test, just trying to assess maximum lactate from those or from one of those time trials as well, just to see, even if it's not a pure VLA max test, we can see maximum lactate concentration. And that's also can also be another good data point. A low maximum lactate value would indicate more of a slow switch profile in many cases, and vice versa, of course, with a high maximum lactate value. So those were my main methods. I think here as well, there's a lot of things, like some coaches use jump tests, like counter movement jumps or strength tests, or even like appearance in terms of how muscular an athlete is. And you could ask an athlete how easily they put on muscle. And these things have maybe, some of them have more, some of them have less evidence behind them. There's a pretty good paper on that I'll also link to in the show notes from 2024 by by Elina Levens. But yeah, there's lots of things, but I think still the main ones for me are the performances in long versus short events, performances in different types of sessions, that power duration curve, speed duration curve, and then the critical power testing would be the main ones.
Yeah, nice. I mean, just on the VLA max, if an athlete doesn't have a lactate meter, I like to look at kind of the durability over longer sessions, right? And if they find like they're really needing to fuel a lot, or there's a big drop off there over the more long aerobic work, then you can usually assume that their VLA max is quite high and we maybe need to address that.
Yeah, and you can also, I always, in my critical power test protocol, I always include a 20-second sprint in the same day that I do the 3-minute max test normally. So even though I don't use a 20-second test for the critical power calculation, and I don't use it to measure VLA max directly, but it gives me a bit of a ballpark idea. I can kind of estimate, get a bit of a range for VLA max based on the 20-second sprint anyway. So it's just like, you don't even need to care about what the number is, but a high sprint power for 10 to 20 seconds, that already tells you something, irrespective of the physiological interpretation of it as VLA max or something else, neurological, whatever. Like the functional outcome of that sprint test is going to be important regardless, I think, or it's going to carry information regardless.
Yeah, for sure. And it's maybe important to distinguish between the VLA max and the VO2 max, right? Because a lot of people just think I'm more of a speed oriented athlete, and therefore both of those are going to be strengths, but it's not necessarily always the case. And that's where sometimes looking at the 20 second versus the 5 minute power versus the 20 minute and having all of those data points, we can sometimes see that maybe there's a strength with the VO2 max, but the VLA max is low, or vice versa.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, something that can maybe be overlooked if we're just purely looking at it from a fast twitch versus slow twitch perspective.
Yeah, I've seen some interesting like theories, I think. I can't remember if this was something that was actually more of some formal publication, but no, I think it was just coaches talking about different cycling profiles, like Peter Sagan or people like that, that were really strong in different types of, let's say, one-day races, classics-type racing, and how that relates to potentially having a really high phosphocreatine system, a pretty low VLA max, or at least not too high VLA max, because then they wouldn't have been able to stay with the bunch until the end of a long, long classics day. But then obviously a very high VO2 max. And this way, with a relatively low VLA max, surprisingly, considering the actual like power output that they can produce in the final sprint or in a key selection, maybe a short punchy climb, but that coming a lot of it coming from the VO2 max and even the phosphocreatine system rather than from a strong glycolytic power. So that's something that I've seen, I don't know, bounced around as ideas, but it's not something that I would say that I have any information or any science behind or anything like that, but it's interesting to think about how these different systems play together and in different events as well, how athletes can use that, or how it can be a strength in different events, whereas it might be a weakness in another event. But let's move on to then what I think for me, this is the, actually, before we do that, let's move on to thank our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that are supporting today's episode. So as everybody probably knows, they create carbohydrate products and electrolyte products as well. And one of the implications, so we can tease the next segment already, of physiological profiling for me that I use, is that a fast twitch dominant profile for me needs to be much more diligent with the carbohydrate consumption in training. It doesn't mean that it's not important for slow twitch dominant athletes, but it's more critical, mission critical for fast twitch dominant athletes, just because the glycolysis is higher and they're burning through more carbs generally for the same power if we're talking about equivalent strength athletes. So if you are somebody that feel that, oh, maybe that's you, that picture fits you, and you need some good carbohydrate products to get you through your training, then I think Precision Fuel Hydration make the best products on the market for that. I love the the PF90 gels, especially now for a lot of my training. But yeah, all of their gels are amazing. And the Flow gel for on the bike, you know, half or full distance triathlon is amazing. And you can get 20% off all of their products in your first order with the code TTS2026 on precisionfuelhydration.com. So yeah, then let's discuss the implications in a bit more detail. I mentioned one there already with the carbohydrate consumption for fast twitch dominant athletes. Do you want to continue and discuss a few implications that you see?
Yeah, and it's interesting just to follow up on the Peter Sagan kind of playing around at a professional cyclist level with the ATP-CP versus the VLA max versus the VO2 max and really having to be a bit more on it with each of those factors. In the context that we're talking about, amateur triathlon, then it probably is not quite as important and it is more just fast twitch versus slow twitch, right?
So
yeah I guess I would start on maybe the adjustments that are made to the periodization. So in a more, depending on the profile, we're going to basically spend more or less time focusing on VO2 max work. For example, if we're doing a VO2 max block, then it might be a bit longer for a more slow twitch dominant athlete versus a fast twitch dominant athlete who, although I'm always going to include some VO2 max work, and I think that's something that's important to note as well, is that I think with all profiles, it's important to make sure that we're still touching on all intensities at some point most of the time. Not most of the time as in every week, but most of the time as in at some point throughout the year. But it's more, for me, about shifting the length and duration of those blocks and how heavy we go into the weeds on each of those aspects.
Yeah, no, that 100% agreed. And I would also add there that an additional reason to change the length of a block, like a VO2 max block, for example, is the, again, coming back to that fatigability, that a more slow twitch dominant athlete would be able to continue that block for slightly longer. It's not just that they have maybe more to gain, but they're also able to do it for longer versus you run the risk of reaching a point of overreaching more quickly in a fast twitch dominant athlete by continuing to do that intensity. So that's something to add there as well. I mean, I think volume to me is an interesting one, because I think at the highest level, volume isn't necessarily impacted by physiological profiling, because it's more the intensity of the easy volume and the amount of intensity that for me would change. Even if I have an athlete that is quite fast twitch dominant, but they're trying to be a professional triathlete and trying to be like a world class or make a living as a professional triathlete, which is then you have to be one of the best in the world, really, then for me, you still can and should do high volume, but you need to be really careful with how you do that. So not doing too much intensity, doing the aerobic training at a relatively low intensity compared to the slow twitch dominant athletes that can do it at a slightly higher relative intensity. So, but on an age group level where we also have other fatigue factors or recovery factors, basically we're not able to recover so much because of other life stressors, I do think that in practice, I end up sometimes giving less volume to the fast twitch dominant age group athletes, just because even though in theory it's physiologically possible for them to train more, but in practice it ends up being quite difficult to do that and recover. So I might not use all of the time available to training for that cohort of athletes. Well, this depends on how much volume they have available, but if they have a pretty good amount of volume or time available to train, I might just cut down a little bit on that. And so that's one variable that I think is potentially impacted. Then the intensity in general, I think doing less volume of intensity with fast twitch dominant athletes, again, for that increased rate of fatigue accumulation. And I think this is especially true at intensities where you can do quite a lot of work at intensity, like threshold, sweet spot, tempo. That's where you can really, I think, you can really burn out as a fast twitch dominant athlete by doing like long, big threshold sessions. So that's something that I would be really careful with rest being more on it when it comes to rest and recovery for the fastest dominant athlete, but also within workouts. I would typically, for example, threshold sessions, I tend to give a 3-to-1 work to rest ratio for most athletes. But if I have an athlete in front of me that I know that, okay, they fall clearly towards that side of the spectrum, that they're more fastish dominant, then I might move that up to a 2-to-1 work to rest ratio. So basically across the spectrum of different intensities that I'm working with in training prescription, I would always move the work to rest ratio, what is it? It's a down one step basically. So from 3-to-1 to 2-to-1. So you give more recovery relative to the work for threshold, or in a, something like a sweet spot workout from 4-to-1 to 3-to-1, that sort of thing. That's basically the system that I would go with there. And nutrition, I already mentioned, being even more on it with nutrition with fast twitch dominant athletes. And yeah, I think those are probably the main implications for me. I guess also even things like pacing in different events can be quite important. And even which races you choose to do to some extent. Like if you're somebody who's quite explosive, then you might prefer to do a different type of terrain than somebody who is very much slow twitch dominant and might struggle over that type of terrain, something punchy, for example. So there are some other, those maybe come into play less with age group triathletes, I would say, but it does still happen that becomes also a factor to consider.
Yeah, I really like that a lot. I mean, I echo everything that you said there, really. That last point about race selection is not something that I probably have considered in the context of profiling too much. So, yeah, I like that.
I think it's rare that it happens, though, just because race selection in age group triathlon is typically more...
Sure.
It's not informed by so much by that, or usually not. Usually it's like, this is a race that I want to do that appeals to me, and that's what you go with. So... which is very much fair enough, in my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. But there are still a lot of athletes out there who they just want to have the best performance possible compared to their peers, right? So for them, selecting a race based on purely performance is going to be an option. And yeah, I mean, the only point that I would reiterate or maybe slightly differ is in the fast switch profile athlete and the volume. Yeah, I agree that mostly you said that you maybe reduce it slightly, which maybe I would, but ideally I'm trying to keep that volume pretty high as well in that fast switch athlete. But it is, as you touched on, really the intensity that we really need to be a lot more controlled over. That LT1 in that kind of athlete profile is always going to be a lot lower, and that the RPE at LT1 is going to be a lot lower. So we need to make sure that the more endurance aerobic training, when we're trying to get the adaptations from being below LT1, we need to make sure and be a little bit more strict with the intensity control at that duration. And I typically find that if you can get that right, then we can still maximize volume within the context of most amateurs' kind of life weekly restrictions. Yeah.
I agree. And I guess that's the one that I didn't mention explicitly, although I mentioned it earlier in the episode about the importance of doing the easy training easy enough for that fast twitch profile. So just one follow-up on that specific one for you. How do you prescribe that specifically for if you have an athlete that is fast twitch dominant? Is it, if you use the bike as an example, do you change the RPE that you prescribe or the power that you prescribe? What does that look like in your coaching?
Yeah, I do change the RPE slightly. So with a more slow twitch athlete, I'm more often allowing them to go up to a 4 to 5 out of 10, whereas more of a fast twitch athlete, I'm trying to keep them more 2 to 3 out of 10. And in terms of just general kind of power prescriptions in the endurance rides and paces on the run, I just drop everything back a little bit, simply put. I like to give them heart rate caps more so than I would do as well with a more slow twitch athlete. And quite often they don't like it because they're not used to running or riding so slow most of the time. But it often elicits good results.
Yeah, I think it can be a complete game changer for somebody that has always been, because I think maybe less so now, but I remember 5-10 years ago, maybe you would read a lot of things about, you know, and it was the cognitive zones were so dominant, but basically what everybody wanted to do was to be at that top and also to in the cognitive zone, so riding at 70-75% of FTP all the time. And that's the type of thing that can really kill an athlete that is more of a fast twitch dominant profile. But I guess
it's
I think
training adaptation, right? That's the crux of it, is that you're not hitting usually the objectives of the session. Even if you take out the fact that the recovery is going to be harder, you're not going to be able to do the quality sessions when they come. But it often starts to drift into a slightly different training objective, which over time is not where you want to be.
Yeah, 100%. One thing that I think we should also talk about is whether there are any limitations or caveats that we have around physiological profiling and the implications that we've talked about. So yeah, what would you say, if any, what are the limitations or caveats we should put in place?
I mean, I guess I would probably further my point on volume and just say that volume and load are still the goal within the context of triathlon. So yeah, even if the kind of your profile says that you need to be doing a lot of VO2 max work or the other side, we still need to be maximizing what you can do over the course of a week, month and year. And that's what's going to be ultimately translating to results in the best possible way. I would also say that VO2 max is often limited in amateurs, even with a fast switch profile, right? They don't have the years behind them where, as an elite athlete, you might have hit that ceiling at the VO2 max. So they would typically do more threshold work. Even if your profile is quite fast switch, still lifting the VO2 max is going to bring up everything below that as well, even if your fractional utilization is still quite low. So it's not to neglect any intensity or goal for the sake of your profile, or not to get kind of hung up on too much in this kind of area, I guess.
Yeah, and what I would add only is something that I already mentioned before, but that while I think that it's physiological profiling is an important variable to look at, and it's probably more important than some other variables. For example, I think it's much more important for me in how I prescribe training than the age of an athlete or the sex of an athlete. I'm much more interested in the profile of an athlete when it comes to actually a variable that has an impact on training decisions. But it's still less important than other factors. And primarily, I think the big one there is the overall life stress situation and all the things around that. So that can, in some cases, really be much, much more important if we're talking about an athlete that has more of a very busy, very stressful life situation with limited amounts of recovery for that reason. So yeah, that's the caveat that I would add there. Yeah. So I mean, I think also maybe we can talk about some practical examples. So I'm going to, for people watching on YouTube, I'm going to look over here to the right, to my other screen, where I have some data from, actually just came in, the last day of testing came in this morning. It came in yesterday, but this morning as of when I looked at Training Peaks. So this is an athlete that did a critical power test. The first day was 20 seconds plus 3 minutes. The 20-second test doesn't count in the critical power calculation, but it's for profiling that glycolytic side of things from a very high-end, top-end perspective. Then the second day was a 5-minute test, and the third day was a 10-minute test. I often do a 20-minute test as a third day, but this is an athlete that is relatively new to structured training, even though he's not new to sport, but to structured training, pretty new, at the ripe old age of low 60s. So it's Yeah, that's another interesting thing to look at from that perspective of a slightly older athlete. But the results there for this athlete, and this was the first critical power test he's done since we've been working together. We did a ramp test early on, because I find that for an athlete new to structured training, a ramp test is a good way to just get a ballpark for an FTP, and you can start training with that. But then, and then as the athlete gets a bit more used to pacing and things like that, then I want to pretty quickly replace that with a critical power test to get some more specific and yeah, exact data. So anyway, the results there for these athletes were, the critical power was 256 watts, W prime 19.8 kilojoules, 5-minute power was 322 watts, which gives an estimate for VO2 max of 56 milliliters per kg. There's lots of, actually quite a bit of research on estimating VO2 max from 5-minute power or relative power, relative to weight. So I'll try to remember to link to one study in the show notes as well for that. Actually by a past guest on the show, who's also coming up very soon as a return to the show, Sebastian Sitko. But yeah, coming back to the test. So critical power 256 watts, W prime 90.8 kilojoules. I have been on record on this podcast saying that I would generally see that when you're approaching that 20 kilojoules, that's basically a relatively moderate or maybe moderate high W prime for a triathlete. But it's also one thing that is important to remember, and this is why I wanted to talk about this as an example, is that W prime is also relative to the critical power itself. So if I say that 20 kilojoules is moderate or maybe moderate high W prime for a triathlete, that's with my like very typical athlete, the type of athlete that I work with a lot, somebody who has a critical power of around 300 watts, give or take a little bit. So quite a bit higher than the 256 watts that we see in this example, meaning that when W prime is high relative to critical power, that actually means that, yeah, W prime here is, I would say, quite high, and especially considering the age of the athlete. So that's not to say that that's a bad thing per se, but that's something that is going to influence how the training decisions for this athlete. So for example, already because of the factor of him being quite new to structured training and also the age, we've been doing the endurance training at a very relatively low intensity. And that's definitely something to continue doing, knowing this, having this information. I think we'll be working quite a bit on fueling as well, because that's something that maybe it's on not so developed yet. Again, not very normal for somebody who is newer to structured training and fueling a bit more. And yeah, then obviously the decision around what intensities to do is also going to be impacted by this. I think that, yeah, the higher power number, the 322 watts for 5 minutes, is actually a very good number for this athlete with his age and this critical power. So probably less of a need to work on the top end there, even though, especially with at this age, like you said, I think it's true for everybody, but I think even more so at when you're getting older, keeping in touch a little bit with VO2 max at all times is important because it's a bit of use it or lose it. But it's maybe not a focus to develop it, more so to maintain it. And if anything, build it up from below by just kind of doing more volume. And this athlete is quite time rich, so I think that a possibility here or an opportunity is to maybe do quite a bit of volume at a low intensity. And I think that that could give some really good results for this athlete.
Nice. Yeah.
No. What are your critiques on that, Jack? I want to hear your critiques.
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously hard to say anything too specific without knowing their swim bike run history load in recent times, but you know, if their life is allowing some moderate volume and there's no good reason in terms of, yeah, niggles, injury type stuff that's going to be a problem, then I think that's a great place to start. And hopefully you see some quite quick progression there. And I would also look to probably retest a little bit sooner than I would with a typical athlete, because of them being new to structured training, so it could quickly become outdated, and we need to make sure that we're checking in. I guess, as I said before, I'd really be stressing the intensity control on the aerobic sessions there as well. But yeah, I'll be asking for an update in the next few months.
Sounds good. Yeah. Well, one other interesting thing, actually, practical thing on the how to test side of things from this testing protocol is that, so I didn't read out the specific power numbers from the tests, but I'll do it now. So 3 minute average power was 319, 5 minutes, 322. Red flag, right? Your 5 minute power can't be higher than your 3 minute power. And then 10 minute power, 289 watts. Well, this obviously is less likely to happen for a more experienced athlete, but still, what happens in this case is that obviously I throw out the 3 minute test. I don't use it. And this is one reason that I think that doing three different tests can be quite good, because if one of them is clearly not aligned to the other two, you can choose to use just the other two and use them in your critical power calculation. So that's what I did in this example. So that's just a practical tip, and it's more relevant for people that are maybe haven't done a critical power test and are not so used to doing these types of time trials. That could be could be quite useful. And if you actually plot out you convert it to, instead of power versus time, you do kilojoules versus time, and you plot it out, then this should form a fairly, like, obviously there's some variation, but it should form a straight line, essentially a linear relationship. And it's not going to be completely straight, but the point is that you want to find that linear relationship. And if one of them is clearly off, then you can easily see that by plotting it out, and it's very easy to do that in Excel or Google Sheets or something like that. Do you have Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's no secret that max power tests are really hard to get right often, and having the third one in there is a great way to see any anomaly. I mean, I'd said that I do mine on the same day, which kind of is for the similar reason, not just for minimizing training interruption, but the fact that I know that the athlete is on the same kind of day, as in their training status, their nutrition status, their fatigue status is always exactly the same for both of those tests. Obviously, the second one, I know they've got the fatigue from the first one in their legs, but it at least is consistent, rather than sometimes, especially with new athletes, their numbers can be a little bit all over the place. And so it's hard to, I mean, you said about the ramp test, right? Which is such a lot easier to get right. So definitely urge people to use that.
Yeah. I'm putting you on the spot, but do you have any example that comes to mind? Not talking about specifically critical power testing necessarily, but just a recent example of how you have used some form of profiling in training, in coaching decisions with one of your athletes.
Yeah, so I mean, there's one athlete. Oh, this is that the best one to use? Yeah, there's one athlete that I've been working with for a few years, and we did a recent round of testing, and there is a very small gap between his LT1, LT2, and his higher end power as well. So even though that's not been the case historically, he did a lot of Ironman. He did two Ironman blocks last year, so it's obviously, that curve has been flattened to quite an extreme point. So even though it was always in the plan to have a bit more of a VO2 max emphasis, I mean, this is going back a couple of months now, but I really kind of doubled down on that, basically. And not only for that VO2 max block, but then I've also sprinkled in more VO2 max block periodically or on a more regular basis as well, off the back of that kind of those tests and that profiling.
Do you use a different types of VO2 max sessions for an athlete like that who has a flat power curve versus what you would use for somebody who has an explosive, a fast twitch athlete, basically?
Yeah, I mean, the data says that the microintervals are better for that type of athlete, right?
But which type of athlete?
For the slow twitch type athlete. Yep. However, I always go to the micro intervals for all athlete profiles, usually in the context of triathlon, just because I think when you're managing swim, bike, and run, and you want to get as much time close to VO2 max, the micro intervals are just a much more palatable and easier way to do that. So I would do it differently if I was focusing on more of a single discipline athlete. But I think in the context of triathlon, the micro intervals, the 30-15s, the 30-30s, the 40-20s, and just breaking up the sessions into more kind of on-off type work works really well as a triathlete. What's your take there? Interested for your...
I agree with that, except I'm not a big fan of 30-30s or like the 1-to-1 work to rest ratio for micro intervals, just because I know that, I think that there hasn't been so much like modern science on those that I think a lot of the studies on those intervals were done by Veronique Villat in, I'm going to get the years wrong, maybe in the first decade of the 2000s.
I don't think it matters.
I don't think it doesn't matter, but a fairly long time ago, all things considered. Okay. And I just think that, and I know that that was mainly based in running, and the speeds to get VO2 max up were very high. And that's for the same reason that you said that in triathlon, you're carrying all the fatigue. I would ideally like to avoid very high speeds. So that's why I would opt for 30-15s, because whether it's on the bike or on the run, it's admittedly a bit harder to execute, but it can be done. I think a treadmill is a good, really good option there. But you limit a bit the peak power you have to go to, because the recoveries are so short that you're driving up the oxygen uptake just by the fact that you still have a 2-to-1 work rest ratio. You're doing like twice the amount of hard work as you get to rest, and the rests are pretty much non-existent because 15 seconds is nothing. Or 40-20s, equally a fan of 40-20s pretty much, or even 60-30s, at least on the bike. It's something that I've been exposed to quite a bit, and that's been very effective in my experience as well. So yeah, I think I agree with everything you said, but except that I prefer the 2-to-1 work rest ratio for the micro intervals.
I also prefer those. The 30-30s, I mean, I typically would use them with more of an older athlete or someone who I feel like they are unable to push or kind of access that kind of energy system as well with the 30-30s in terms of power. Sorry, in terms of power, not so much energy system, but yeah, my go-to is a 30-15 or a 40-20.
But even if you want a little bit of a small dose of VO2 max and moderate dose of glycolytic stimulus, then the 30-30s become a pretty good option. It is context dependent, but just for pure VO2 max is where I prefer the 30-15s. One other topic that I had in mind that maybe right now is not super relevant for us personally as coaches, but it definitely has been at some points of our lives and probably will be again in the future. And also as athletes, we've both experienced group training environments, right? And this is an interesting challenge for coaches and for athletes. When you set up a group environment, let's say as an example, a squad swim, you have swimmers of different profiles, but you're kind of limited in what adaptations that you make within a session. Basically, in most cases, and it ends up being that the athletes do the same session for obvious reasons. It's almost impossible to do anything else. But what's your take there? What are some, not just in swimming, but in general in squad group training, squad environments, what are some things that can be done there to accommodate different physiological profiles?
Yeah, it's a difficult challenge for the coach to manage sessions. In the pool, it's probably the hardest, right? Because you're sharing a lane and you have to stick to the same turnarounds. But it could be the fact that if you're a fast twitch athlete and you want to limit your anaerobic or high-end exposure, then you could just drop to the back of the lane and make it into more of a continuous swim. Or even sometimes if a group are doing some more intensity with bigger rests, you could go into a faster lane and just swim it as more of a continuous aerobic swim if they're on a tighter turnaround, for example. And yeah, I mean, I think it's easier to do in the bike and run is to just stick to what the coach has given you, basically. But I mean, I would always I'd always caveat that by saying that the load is still the most important thing over time, right? So if going to those group sessions makes it easier for you to get out the door and get the training done, regardless of whether it's the most optimal training for your profile, then I think that needs to be considered. And it may be the fact that you alternate weeks that you're doing the group training or whatever. But I think there's a lot to be gained from training with others from a motivation or technical perspective that is often worth the compromise. What are your thoughts?
I think that's my main thought with what you ended on there. Basically, as long as you avoid really bad mistakes, then I don't think we should overthink it. We shouldn't necessarily look to optimize every session, because I don't think that you're really gaining anything from that compared to just doing the training. But you do want to make sure that you avoid mistakes that would lead to, for example, overreaching or training, that sort of thing. So that's where things like you said, how a swimmer could adjust where they swim behind others in the same lane or change into a different lane. That those are the kinds of adaptations that you could use. If it's running, then if you have a couple of different pace groups out on the track, for example, adjusting to something that works, or maybe even if your running group is doing two track sessions and a very solid long run in a week, that's probably going to be too much for a lot of athletes, and then maybe choosing to skip one of the track sessions or skip the long run, something like that. Yeah, you do want to avoid the mistakes. So it comes down to, I think as a first step, talk with the coach and hear what they have to think about what kind of athlete you are, share your thoughts with them and discuss how that can work within the squad environment. But I think that not overthinking it is also important. And yeah, I think there are absolutely things that can be done, simple things that can be done on the track, for where a coach can give different pace targets to, or change the number of intervals even for athletes that are more fatigable. So let's say the fast twitch athletes. So there are some small things that you could do, and the same would go in the pool. Actually changing the number of intervals is probably the simplest thing, and maybe the work to rest ratio. Those are two simple changes that I as a coach would make if I'm in that situation, and that can be quite relatively easily manageable. Maybe less so in the pool, as you said, because then you have to kind of, do they wait around until they move on to the next part of the session, or do you have an asynchronous session? So that ends up being a bit challenging again. But yeah, it falls a bit both on the coach and the athlete, I would say, in that situation.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, any good coach should be able to do everything they can to accommodate, right? I mean, I think the running club is a bit of a classic one, and a good way of managing that is if they are quite often smashing, more middle distance type rep sessions at most of your local running clubs, is that you maybe do half of the session and then finish off with some tempo effort or something. And that way because as we touched on, it's always still good to stay in touch with all intensities, even if it's not the optimal focus point for you. But that way you still get the best of both worlds.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think that's a good solution. And I guess we're approaching the end here, so maybe let's wrap it up with a couple of key take-home messages each. I can start here because I have a couple of notes in front of me. And so if I give two take-home messages from today's episode to the listener, it would be, number one, to try to identify where you sit on the physiological profile spectrum. And this can be starting with more subjective observations or subjective/objective, looking at past race performance, looking at training enjoyment, those sorts of things, but then also moving on to direct testing through critical power, critical speed, lactate, those sorts of things, and get a good idea of where you sit. And then if you are, my advice is then, like, take-home message is going to be directed to the fast twitch dominant athletes, because I think that that's much more important. Because that's where training mistakes can be more costly And if that's you, if you are more fast twitch dominant, then I would really pay attention to avoiding doing your endurance work at too high an intensity, and avoiding doing too much intensity in general, and especially I would say the type of intensity sessions where you accumulate high volumes like threshold or other heavy domain work. So those would be my key take home messages from today's episode.
Yeah, nice. If you've given a focus to a fast twitch athlete, I'll go for a focus for a slow twitch athlete then. And I would say that don't get hung up on specificity. Never let the VO2 max work, and don't panic that it's not what you're doing on race day, because often that the VO2 max is such a big limiter or correlation, especially in amateur athletes, where, as I said before, their ceiling is not topped out. So yeah, that's my tips for a slow twitch athlete. And then the more general tip would be, or takeaway would be, that most athletes still need exposure to all intensities. So the profiling is going to shape the emphasis a little bit, but it's not the be all and end all. And you still need to make sure that you're getting some exposure to everything, and good volume and load is going to be the big driver to adaptations and performance.
That's excellent. What you said there about VO2 max, that reminded me of something I've been thinking about a bit. So it's not related to today's topic necessarily, but I think that it would be easy for an age group triathlete to look at YouTube videos or Strava or the different sources of information on how pros are training. And although some of them are doing a fair bit of VO2 max, a lot of them probably aren't. What I'm thinking about that is that a lot of pros are basically maxed out on VO2 max, and they reach their genetic potential through years of high volume and also high intensity, and they can mostly maintain that maximum potential VO2 max through just continuing to do load and maybe a little sprinkle of high intensity from time to time. So they don't really need much of that, but although a little bit, yes, but In, and there might be exceptions there for sure. But basically, my take here is that amateur triathletes looking at what the pros are doing and maybe seeing heavy threshold bias in many cases, that misses the fact that they've already reached their potential in terms of VO2 max. And the only place you can go from there is to try to raise your threshold as a percentage of VO2 max, and of course your race percentage, your fractional utilization at your racing VO2 as well. So basically that's a bit of a red herring if you look at what the pros are doing there, because for amateurs the discrepancy in VO2 max between different people is just so much larger, and most amateurs haven't really tapped out or reached their genetic potential for VO2 max, so it's much more worth it to try to pursue that a bit more. What's your take on that?
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think I touched on it, a similar point earlier in the podcast. So yeah, I'm glad that you're emphasizing it further. Yeah, I think the timing of it is important though, right? Even though I said don't worry about that, you're not doing the specificity, you do need to make sure that we are tuning the body in terms of its kind of glycolytic tendencies as we get closer to racing, especially if you're doing an Ironman. So that's the caveat on the flip side, but 100% agree with everything you said there.
So let's do one final question for today. So in some of our previous episodes, we did a final segment that was Jack's surprise question. Well, now it's going to be Michael's surprise question. And the question is actually a statement rather than a question. So I'm gonna ask you to either strongly agree or strongly disagree. And the statement is, a slow twitch dominant profile has a better chance of becoming an elite short course triathlete than a fast twitch dominant profile.
Strongly disagree. And I'm going to use the phrase, turning a miler into a marathoner is easier than the reverse. The VO2 max ceiling is, as we've just talked on, is harder to develop than the fractional utilization. So elite short course triathlon requires a high VO2 max. And so that's going to be my go-to.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your take? Do you agree?
I agree with that. Although I wouldn't necessarily just equate VO2 max to the fast switch, because the fast switch, the VO2 max might be, you could have a slow switch and a fast switch athlete with, like, VO2 max is fundamentally aerobic, right? But
sure.
but I still think that just the glycolytic ceiling that you have gives you a really good capacity to continue to develop VO2 max, and also that tends to come with really good mechanical characteristics, like, you know, excellent running mechanics where you're actually able to run really fast. And it just sets your potential to continue to develop VO2 max higher potentially. So that's, yeah, I would agree with that and I do think that's that example of it's easier to develop a miler into a marathoner than the other way around. I mean, I think it would be impossible to develop an elite marathoner into an elite miler, probably, if you're talking about the top end. Like, that's just not going to work. We could look at the same thing in triathlon, like an elite Ironman or a world-class Ironman athlete into a world-class sprint distance triathlete. It's just not going to happen. But the other way around, it happens consistently. Every year we have more people coming over from short course. So yeah, I agree. Just maybe some of the, yeah, maybe VO2 max is what I would say is not even like as relevant to that as other factors.
Yeah, no, I'll correct myself there. That was a wrong statement from myself.
Well, it was still a good and firm statement on your side, and that's what we want with that finish strong, finish on a with an interesting kind of way. And that's it for today. So thank you everybody for listening, for tuning in. If you haven't subscribed to the podcast, make sure that you do that. And also remember that you can find the podcast on YouTube. And if you're listening on Spotify, we would love for you to answer the poll for today's episode. So every episode I put up a poll where I'm asking you basically how much you enjoyed the episode or didn't enjoy it. And that gives us information to basically try to continue to improve the podcast. So that's great. If you have any questions or comments, then you can either put them in the YouTube comments or in the Spotify comments, wherever there's comments really. But I think those two are the two main places. And also, if you are looking to up your triathlon game or endurance sports in general, we also coach cyclists and runners mainly. We offer coaching at Scientific Triathlon, and also customized training plans, consultations, and ready-made training plans. So there are different options for different needs, different budgets. And yeah, we would love to help you. So if you're interested in working with us and getting some professional help and professional assistance with your training, then reach out. You can find us on scientifictriathlon.com, and all the contact details and further information can be found there. And yeah, that's it. We'll be back again soon. I don't know exactly what next week's episode will be, but there will be another That Triathlon Show episode next week. And Jack will be back in the either next week or in the not too distant future. So in the meantime, thank you, Jack. And to listeners, thank you as always for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.